Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire school districts often say they struggle to cover the costs of special education. So it came as a surprise last month when the State Department of Education reported that over the past decade, districts had left more than $10 million of federal funds for these programs unspent. The department also said in the most recent fiscal period, around $500,000 of these same monies weren't used. Today in The Exchange, we take another look at how special education is paid for and the many challenges administrators, teachers, and parents face these days trying to meet the needs of students. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Jane Bergeron-Beaulieu. She's Executive Director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. And Jane, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Also with us, Bonnie Dunham. She's Law and Policy Specialist at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education. And Bonnie, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Also with us, Santina Thibodeau, State Director of Special Education at the New Hampshire Department of Education. And Santina, a welcome back to you. Thank you for your time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, all of you, but I'll turn to you first, Santina. What is special education? Give us some examples, if you could, please, that just shows the range of what this covers.
So the intent of special education is really to have an individualized service. So thank you, because there's not just a canned answer to this. Special education could be services in a public school district in a classroom. We have some students who may be in a day special ed program and some students who are in a residential program. And again, it's really all based on services that a child needs so that they can be successful in the classroom.
Can you be specific, Santina? Help with reading, help with, just a range of the small and large services that this covers.
So it could be help with reading. It could be help with math. It could be some services so that their behaviors in the classroom, they can remain in the classroom. We hear a lot recently about suspension and expulsion and what are the positive behavior services that students need to stay in the classroom.
In the general education
classroom? In the general education classroom. It could also be some one-on-one type work. When we talk about that reading, it could be in small groups for reading instruction. It could be one-on-one reading instruction. Again, we have to remember that it's individualized to the student, as well as that the parent plays a very important role in the education and in those services for students.
Bonnie, how would you answer that question? What exactly is special education? I'd love some examples of what that means on the ground.
Sure. First of all, it's important for people to know that it's a service, it's not a place. People aren't in special education like it's a whole different room. Most children who receive special education services receive them in the classroom.
Now, that's interesting, and people do often say the way you said it before.
Yeah. Right. For example, my son, who has Down syndrome, he's an adult now, so he benefited from special education. Many of his services were in a general education classroom, having the curriculum modified in advance and tailored to meet his special education needs so that he could benefit from what was being taught.
And how did they manage that, sort of putting him in the general education classroom, even though he didn't learn, quote unquote, like all the other kids? Now we know that everybody learns differently.
For some subjects, we picked what was most important. For example, how in government, instead of knowing the capitals of every state, he learned the capital of New Hampshire. How a bill becomes a law, he really focused on how citizens participate in that. And so they sometimes picked certain segments of the curriculum that would really be focused on for his benefit. And in other cases, it was finding materials that were done through audio instead of written work because he couldn't read well.
Jane, go ahead. I love your thoughts, too. What does special education mean? And I appreciate Bonnie's sort of clarification there. It's a service. It's not a place.
I would echo the things that Santina and Bonnie have said and would add that special education is really designed by teams. And I think that's a really important piece where general educators, administrators, special ed teachers, parents, the student are really responsible for gathering together and designing the special education programs and services that are specific to that child's needs. And we're seeing today in special education kids with more complex learning challenges. And so it's a learning curve for all of us as we work with students who are having very significant kinds of special education challenges.
Wow, so that's really interesting. What kinds of challenges have you noticed growing and getting more complicated in recent years?
Well, we're seeing kids with multiple different disabilities, kids with who have been faced with trauma, emotional problems coupled with learning challenges, as well as challenges with the opioid crisis. All of these things are really impacting our kids with disabilities.
How does that play itself out when a child comes with, trauma, maybe from the opioid crisis, maybe from abuse and neglect? How does that play itself out in terms of what that child is able to learn or has trouble learning?
And that's where the team comes in. You're bringing in the specialists who have the expertise in those variety of areas and putting together a program that can be implemented in the general ed setting with the necessary supports and specialized instruction. It just isn't one individual. It's a variety of folks who are responsible for helping that child through the system.
It's so interesting to hear you say what you said, Jane, about an increase in the number of kids with very complicated learning needs. I just have to wonder why, Bonnie, this is going on.
Well, one of the reasons is because medicine has made tremendous progress, and sometimes children who previously would not have survived are surviving and may have some learning disabilities as a result. Chemotherapy sometimes results in some learning disabilities or other long-term effects that are mild in comparison to the alternative, certainly. There also is the opioid crisis and other factors that have led to children not only sometimes being born with a disability as a result of having been exposed to substances while prenatally, but also in their early developmental years being affected. And one of the nice things is that the things that we've learned from special education and how to modify curriculum, how to provide supportive environments, are able to be translated to children who've experienced trauma but do not have disabilities.
That's interesting. So you're better able to help those kids based on what we've learned in the past 30, 40, 50 years that public schools have been doing special education services.
Particularly the past 20 years, I'd say. We've gotten better and better at it.
What have you noticed, Santina, in terms of what has changed in this field, say, in the past 10 years?
I think in the past 10 years, as Bonnie had said, that our counterparts in regular ed, they're really learning from special education. We have a lot more efforts going on in our classrooms for something called social-emotional learning, so that all students have that student wellness piece, where I think probably 10 years ago, it was all being placed onto special ed. So we have the social-emotional learning. We're doing a lot with trauma-informed classrooms, which is really having our classroom teachers understand what does trauma look like compared to behavior, so that if they're aware of it, they can intervene without always having to make a referral to special education.
Can you elaborate on that, Bonnie, that trauma can be linked to behavior, and that when we're more aware of trauma, we can address the behavior instead of saying, you're a bad kid, you're out of here, go in the hallway or go to the principal's office?
Absolutely. I think a simple example is if a child happens to grab an extra lunch and bring it to their locker. It may not be because they're stealing it with ill intent. It may be that they have experience with not having enough food, and so when food is available, they're going to take it so that they can have it when it becomes scarce again. And so many of the behaviors are protective, and through what we've learned, we're able to then translate that into providing supports, recognizing that this child has a problem, not this child is a problem.
How would you answer that question, Jane? How has special education, the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, the way we deliver it in this state, how has it changed in the past decade?
Well, you know, I think the whole challenge of implementing what we call multi-tiered systems of support, which means starting with what Santina described as having curriculum, social-emotional curriculum for all kids, so that kids with disabilities are welcomed in the school and the teachers are prepared, and then having interventions for kids at a variety of different levels depending upon the significance of the challenges for them. That's something that we really have been stressing in our schools, is not only just supporting kids with disabilities, but creating systems of support for all kids. And I think we're still learning and growing in that area.
What's the latest feeling, Jane, in terms of how much inclusion in the regular classroom, for lack of a better word, and how much special side services? And I know you can't answer that question neatly and cleanly because every school is different, every child is different, but I am struck by the terms special education, general education, sort of putting people in two different categories sometimes isn't helpful.
Yeah, and we try not to do that. And I think it becomes more of a challenge as kids become more complex, more aggressive. I think that's where the biggest challenges lie, in ensuring that we have enough supports and training for all of our staff to ensure that we can support these kids in very productive and safe ways and create caring and safe learning environments for all of our kids, not just kids with disabilities.
How do schools react? Anybody can jump in, but I'll turn to you first, Jane. When, you know, there's children in a special education class and some of the reasons that Bonnie outlined, that child is disruptive. And so how do you manage that, where the child is distracting other kids from learning what they need to learn? It's tough because you don't want to separate people out. You want to do your best. On the other hand, the other kids are having a hard time learning because someone is acting out.
Hopefully
we hear these stories all the time.
We do, and hopefully we're preparing our educators to have strategies to deal with that and to have the specialists available to support the general ed teachers in redirecting, having appropriate behavioral strategies to work with them that are all positive in nature so that it's not disrupting the learning environment.
Bonnie, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I think that some distractions are always going to happen, and it's not just because a child has a disability. It may be that the football team just won the championship, and so the captain comes into class and everyone stops and celebrates. People don't think of that as a disruption as much as they do when a child with a disability hops out of his seat three times to sharpen his pencil because he has a hard time sitting still. There tends to be more of a focus on that. And in reality, when a teacher is able to use some best practices and they can just generally transition back into the learning so that the disruption is minimalized. And for most children with disabilities, the disability isn't even always known to their peers. Their classmates just think of him as Billy or Susie, and because special education is not public knowledge. It's not something everyone is aware of. In my case, our son has Down syndrome. It's pretty obvious. But in most cases, it's a learning disability or a learning difference. And when teachers use universal design for learning in a classroom, everyone can benefit, including children with disabilities who may have some more unique challenges.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The number here on the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, we are taking another look at how special education is paid for, and we're finding out about some of the challenges that administrators, teachers, parents, and kids face these days trying to meet the needs of special education students, especially in the general classroom. Let's hear from you. Our email again is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Michael, who says, my daughter has received special ed services or interventions since her birth for speech and reading. She suffered a stroke at birth. Wow, Michael, that's hard. She stopped receiving services this year. She is in second grade. During parent-teacher conferences this year, her teacher told me that services were administered not on a threshold test score, but on her position relative to other kids in her class. This struck me as wrong. What am I missing? Michael, thank you for the email. And Bunny, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Sure. It's not so much the threshold of the class, because that would mean depending on which classroom you were in, you may or may not be eligible for special education. It really is based on how the child has progressed and how they're performing in comparison to what you would expect for a child of that age or grade level. And so that child may have developed enough coping mechanisms through all of the years of special education that they are able to receive an appropriate education with maybe some mild accommodations and not special education.
Well, Michael, thank you for the call. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Bernice is in Londonderry. Hi, Bernice. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a grandson who was early on diagnosed with borderline Asperger's. And I have heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, and perhaps your panel could help with this. I have heard that that particular designation or label or diagnosis has been renamed, and now sensory disorder is a big sensory processing disorder is, I guess, quite a common a challenge these days. But that particular label doesn't qualify for any special education funding. And my daughter-in-law has been trying for about 2 years now to try to get proper services for my grandson, and because he is he doesn't fall into educationally wise, he is top of his class, but he has sort of behavior modification issues.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
To this point, the school still will not put him on an IEP or a 540. They keep referring her back to her OT. We discovered that the school district had $50,000 left over last year. They were just given another $100,000 this year. So, you know, where would we go to try to, you know, find a solution for these challenges? Here is a child who clearly needs help but isn't getting the help he needs.
Real interesting. Bernice, I'm so glad you called. And good luck, by the way, with your grandson. An IEP, an individual education program. Bernice's call, all of you, raises so many questions. And one is, and I'll turn to you first, Santina, who is eligible for special education services? There's this whole sort of labeling and diagnosis, and sometimes you fall within eligibility and sometimes you don't.
Right. So what we're hearing is that anyone can make a referral for special education. And once that referral is made, there's a variety of evaluations that would be done. And then after that, the team would sit and a decision would be made. Although we have to keep in mind, students who are eligible for special ed need two things. They need to have a disability, and the second piece is that they need specially designed instruction and related services. So we heard from Bernice, and congratulations to your grandson, top of his class, that academically he is performing very well. But when we think about Asperger's and the sensory, in our classrooms, the teachers are doing a lot for sensory overload, is what we used to call it, and how do we make an environment so that the number of distractions or the loud noises or the lights minimize that overload.
Well, and she also mentioned the special education money from the federal government that went unspent, and that's the headline that kind of got us thinking that we should talk about this today. So we will pick that up after a short break. Bernice, thank you again for the call. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, or email us, like Michael did, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
When you give now to support the news you trust from NHPR, not only will you help to shorten the March Fun Drive, you'll also be entered to win an incredible trip to Anchorage, Alaska, where you can soar above the glaciers, stay up late to see the northern lights or the midnight sun. You'll also be entered to win our grand prize, a trip for two to Honolulu, Hawaii, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. Give now to support the NHPR programs you love at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, special education in the Granite State. We're following up on a surprising headline from a few weeks ago that New Hampshire school districts had not spent more than $10 million of federal special education funds over the past decade. We're finding out what this means and taking another broader look at these programs. And let's hear from you. If you're involved in this system as a parent or an educator, or just if you have general questions or observations, as someone who isn't directly connected to what special education is all about, again, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Santina Thibodeau, State Director of Special Education at the New Hampshire Department of Education, also Bonnie Dunham, Law and Policy Specialist at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education, and Jane Bergeron-Beaulieu, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. And just before the break, we heard from Bernice, who was frustrated that her grandson was not getting the services that she felt he might need. I'd love to hear from you too, Bonnie, on this, because it does raise the broader question, who's eligible for services and who isn't?
Sure. In the federal and state special education law, there's a definition, and there are different categories, including autism spectrum disorder and intellectual disability, specific learning disability. Each is defined, and so you can look and see, does that definition fit that child? Sometimes a child, like Bernice's grandson, may have some special needs, but it may not rise to the level where the child needs specialized instruction. A child who has such sensory overload that they're easily distracted may just need some accommodations or some sensory strategies, but that child may also need some special education support to learn some coping mechanisms and to learn how to participate in the classroom so that they can benefit from the entire educational experience, not just the pure academic piece.
Well, and Jane, our caller Bernice, also mentioned the millions of dollars that went unspent, the federal special education monies. This was highlighted by Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue 4 or 5 weeks ago. And a lot of people said, whoa, I thought New Hampshire struggled to pay for special education. What's this money doing still sitting on the table? I want to hear from everybody on this because there's been a lot of discussion about it. But Jane, how would you answer that question? What happened there?
In terms of why the monies weren't spent?
Yeah.
You know, I think there are a variety of different factors that really come to play in trying to answer that question. You know, one is around the turnover in staff that we have with our special ed administrators and the need to support them as they put together their grants and monitor them. We've talked with the Department of Education about how we can work together to make sure that our new folks have the support and communication that they need so that when they're navigating that highly regulated grant system, that we're all working together to support folks to make sure that not only are money spent, but the grants are being written in the appropriate ways.
So it's just lack of experience in what it takes to grab these grants and put them to work?
Well, I think that's just one factor. And when you speak with administrators, or at least special ed administrators, the process by which getting the grants approved can be very lengthy. There can be differing interpretations on what's acceptable, what's not. Monies need to be set aside in your IDEA grants to put towards private schools who have kids with disabilities. If that money is not spent, special ed administrators need to work with the department on adjusting their grants. So they think there's a lot of complicated factors as you navigate the field of grant writing in general, not just IDEA grants.
I'd love to hear from everybody on this. Go ahead, Bonnie. Again, when this came out about a month ago, a lot of people said, wow, I could have put that money to use, you know, for my child. Go ahead.
I'm sure lots of people thought that. And I don't know what exactly happened. I don't work at the department. I don't have that insight. But I do know that it can be a complicated process. And the real key is to find out how it happened and to put in place some practices so that it doesn't happen again, because what it definitely does not mean is that we have an overabundance of funding for special education. There are still lots of shortages, and certainly we could be doing better by maximizing the federal funds and using them in wise ways.
Well, sure, because that's the impression that the general public has. Wow, they must not have needed the money, but you're saying that's absolutely not the case.
Oh, absolutely not the case.
What are the shortages? Every single, you know, type of industry that I talk to on this program says we need workers. We're losing professionals. People are retiring. Young people aren't coming into these fields. What does the field of special education need right now, Bonnie?
For example, we hear at the Parent Information Center about shortages in paraprofessional personnel, school nurses.
What is a paraprofessional?
It's an assistant who will work either with an individual child who may need some assistance maneuvering throughout all or some of the day, or who may offer some overall classroom support so that the teacher can focus on broader instruction. The school nursing shortages, the different personnel or shortage areas for different types of disabilities. I know that Santina has at the department a list of critical shortage areas. The funding issue also is one that parents worry about, because they worry about being blamed for high taxes in their communities. At town meetings, it's pretty uncomfortable when taxes are discussed and everyone looks at that parent, when in reality, the cost of not providing special education is so, so much more expensive, because through special education in New Hampshire, we have one of the highest rates of children leaving school with disabilities who are employed or in college after they finish school, a year after they finish school. So we really are getting good bang for our bucks.
So making the effort early on, you're saying, pays off overall for the New Hampshire state government. Maybe you have fewer people incarcerated or fewer people unemployed.
Absolutely.
I have to ask you too, Santina, about the money, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
Sure. So when you had mentioned the $10 million, I really see that as two pots, and one of my roles as a department is to oversee that financial piece. So many of the articles talk about that $10 million, and it was a way that we were working with our districts and doing the special ed funds. That it was a carryover process. And about 3 years ago, we were informed that we could no longer do that. And so what you'll hear is our commissioner talk about petitioning the federal government. And where we are now is that we'd like to get permission to redistribute that money out, with the hopes, as we're all working together, to really look at what are some of our needs. And as Bonnie said, staffing is the largest need that we have now. Qualified people, whether they're teachers, speech and language pathologists, are in desperate need. School psychologists. So our hope is that we'll get that permission and that $10 million will go back out into our districts.
It's kind of crazy when you think about it, isn't it? That, you know, you have a federal grant. You desperately need a speech pathologist and a psychologist at your school.
Yes.
You've got the money to pay for it. And you can't find the
right
person. And so you lose the money.
At this point, that second pot of money is the lost money. One of the things that our bureau did was we worked with Granite State to have two new teacher prep programs. One was for a teacher who would work with students who were blind, and then the other one was for teachers who want to work with students who are deaf, with the intent of, could we homegrown our own teachers here in the state?
Let's take another call, and this is Stephanie. Go ahead, Stephanie. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So one of my concerns is that at-risk students are still really falling through the cracks. There are a lot of students who learn in a variety of different ways and need accommodations, and some schools are very open to, you know, whatever you have to do to meet the needs of every student, and you can shoot to giving different options to doing things. At other schools, I've met many students who are at risk, or they have, you know, need of accommodations, and you'll hear that they weren't tested or they don't have any, you know, disability that is showing that they know of. And so those students are left behind. So I feel like we're still not reaching all of our students, and we're looking at many students as in need of special ed accommodations when really education should be reaching everyone. And finally, I'm super concerned about the possibility that New Hampshire could be taking money out of education funds to give it to the utilities, who are not struggling at all. Our education really needs to come first.
Well, thank you for the call, Stephanie. I really appreciate it. And Santine, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yes. So thank you for your comments, Stephanie. There's a national movement called Universal Design for Learning, and it was a movement that had started when we think about the barriers to our architects. So rather than steps, we'll see a ramp. And that movement has come into education, working with our classroom teachers to really look at what are the barriers to learning. So if someone is not maybe they're doing a book report, and rather than the traditional paper and pencil for every student, this teacher, through Universal Design for Learning, might say, you could show your knowledge of the book by giving an oral presentation to the classroom. And that goes with what students' strengths are, and it's really about removing the barriers. And again, as you were saying, although it's not, let's not think of it as always to accommodate, let's think of it as removing the barriers.
And working with somebody's strengths, which I see that in general education with my own two kids. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to do something on this book. I can give an oral report, I can make a video presentation, or I can write a traditional essay. So it's kind of spilling over into all aspects of education. Jane, go ahead.
I would just add to that that, you know, when we think about funding and we think about kids at risk, what we're seeing is our more resource-rich districts have more interventions to provide to all kids. And that you will see that the districts that may not have as many resources don't have those interventions that are offered to all kids. We're finding that if you can catch kids early, do those early interventions, you're going to catch a lot of those kids that are at risk. And
when
not
you
all
say
schools
at risk, what does that mean exactly?
Typically, it's a student who doesn't qualify for special education services yet is struggling in the general ed setting, whether it be struggling emotionally, socially, or academically, and needing just that extra boost and that intervention to get him back up to speed.
When you say resource rich, I mean, this is the million-dollar question in New Hampshire, but what does that mean, resource rich? And what's the difference between a resource rich town and a resource poor town?
I would describe a resource-rich community, one that has all the staffing that they need, has multiple interventions for all kids, has the opportunity to have kids learning outside of the school walls with extended learning coordinators, just having all kinds of opportunities for all students and the resources and money and support to implement all of that.
Where does the bulk of special education money come from? Maybe you first, Santina, mm-hmm. but anybody else can jump in.
The bulk of our special education monies come from the federal government. They're known as IDEA funds. But one of an interesting piece is, and sometimes we hear the myth of, if a school district identifies more students, then they're going to have more students with IEPs, then they're going to get more money.
So there's an incentive to say, 30% of our kids have right. special education needs, so please give us more funds attached to those children.
And for our IDEA funds, that's simply not true.
Really?
Really. So the calculation does not include the current number of students with IEPs. So, and that's always a comment I'm making as people are calling, or as Bonnie had said, you know, tax season is coming or our budget season. So it comes from our federal funds. We do have some state funds, and then again our local funds.
And when you talk about local funds, you mentioned this earlier, Bonnie. So we've got the federal funds. We've got some state funding, which we'll talk about in a moment. But talk about the tension kind of on the ground with the local funds, especially as we're heading into town meeting season.
Sure. One of the tensions is that the
amount of funding that is used for special education in a community isn't always clear to the taxpayer. It always shows how much money is spent, but I don't think it's always 100% clear on how much comes back through the IDEA funding, through Medicaid to schools programs, and in other resources, through state aid to special education. So what many people see is the gross cost and not the net cost. The other piece that they don't see, as I said earlier, is the cost of not providing special education.
Down the road.
Because taxes pay for prisons and taxes pay for all kinds of government subsidies that people need if they aren't able to graduate and get a job. And so there definitely are lots of costs that come into play. And parents of children with disabilities are taxpayers, too. And so we are not in the business of wasting tax money by any stretch of the imagination.
Go ahead, Jane.
And I would add to that that the special education aid over the years has gone down.
From the state.
Yeah. And in general, the complexity of the kids is going up. And so special ed administrators are really seeing that, you know, this is a real challenge. As we get more complex kids, we're not getting additional funding, as Santina pointed out. And it's just putting us in a very difficult place.
Well, Governor Sununu actually addressed that topic briefly in his budget address last week, speaking about special education funding and the state's role. So let's hear.
I think we can all agree that every student, regardless of ability or disability, deserves a quality education. For nearly 10 years, the state has flat-funded special education in our schools. These reimbursements, which go to local school districts, also help offset local property taxes. But today, that changes. We're increasing the special education funds nearly 20% so that each and every student has an access to an education that suits their needs.
Again, that's Governor Sununu in his budget address last week. So how did that hit your ears, Jane? Given what you said just recently about how the state funding has been not adequate.
Certainly that's a step in the right direction. You know, and at some point, hopefully we can fully fund special education and all of the related needs. Our association really hasn't gotten together to talk about this, but I would assume that, you know, obviously anything is a step in the right direction.
Well, it was just last Thursday, so everybody's still sifting through the numbers, so I appreciate that. Let's go back to our listeners, and Kathy sent us an email from Conway. Kathy says, 27 years ago, I attended a Parent Information Center training in Concord, focused on becoming an advocate for children who have special needs and may not have a parent or parent who can navigate through the system of special ed. 1 year later, my 4.5-year-old had a debilitating stroke. I needed my training and the thick book of laws given to me in my training to help my own child. I give the school district tremendous credit for helping my daughter throughout her schooling. However, without my knowledge and vigilance straight through college, she would not be the successful college graduate that she is today. I would suggest more advocacy training throughout our state, as parents do not know what they do not know. Wow, Kathy, what a story, and I'm glad to hear that your daughter came out of it. This is for you, Bonnie. You know, it is complicated, and if you're just your average person, you need help.
Right. It is complicated, particularly when a parent is first told or first comes to the realization that their child might have a disability, your mind just shuts down. And so at that moment, anything would seem complicated. But the Parent Information Center has lots of free materials on our website, and we can send them through the mail that make that process a little more user-friendly. Some of our materials are 1 page, 10 pages, 20 pages long. So we do try to make it available to parents in a way that they can understand. We also offer free training all around the state, but of course we can only train people who show up, and so we really would be thankful for any help in getting the word out about those trainings.
Well, and if you're a parent who's struggling, especially with a new diagnosis, it may be hard to get out and attend one of those trainings.
Which is why we have online trainings also.
Right. And I'm guessing, and we'll talk about this after a break, that those trainings vary from town to town, from city to city, because the situation is so different among the different districts here in New Hampshire. Thank you for that email, Kathy. And we'll take a lot more of your questions and comments after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in our show, we follow up on a recent Concord Monitor series called Fighting Back about intimate partner violence. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at special education, and let's get you into our conversation. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners, and Kimberly's calling from Concord. Hi, Kimberly. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really am grateful for the opportunity. I really want to give a big props to the city of Concord and the educators in the city of Concord. My son started in Concord when he was in kindergarten, and he got all the support and the IEP that he needed. I made the mistake of moving to a town outside of Concord. They took away his support. They took away his IEP, and that goes to what your previous email was talking about, navigating the system is difficult. But I got us back to Concord. He has his support back, and he's doing amazing. And just want to say, Millbrook, you are the most awesome school ever. And I'm so grateful for the city of Concord. I can't say it enough.
Wow.
They're doing amazing things with the kids and helping them when they need it, and not just trying to pigeonhole them. You take away their supports and they start struggling, and then they want to claim it's a behavioral problem, but it's because they took their supports away.
Really interesting, Kimberly, to hear from you. And there's two points that you make that I want to sort of tease out with our guests. And one, Jane, is the idea that you take the supports away and all of a sudden it becomes a behavior problem. And, you know, oh, why are you acting out? And why are you disrupting the class? Instead of, oh, what do you need? I just wonder how you interpret that, or how often you see it.
Well, the services provided to kids are obviously decided by the IEP team, so I'm not sure why the services were taken away and why the teams made those decisions, but obviously putting those supports in place are going to make the students successful, the culture within the school, making sure that all kids are accepted are of vital importance, and when kids don't get the services that they need, they can react with acting out behaviors.
What about the town-by-town difference that she saw, Bonnie? I wonder what you hear from other parents. Again, she didn't name the other town, but she said it was a town outside of Concord, and she saw huge differences.
Right. It shouldn't matter where you live, because the special education laws provide every eligible child with a free, appropriate public education that's determined by the child's IEP team. But in reality, some schools in some districts have figured out things better than others. And so one school district may have a model program for children with autism spectrum disorder, while another may have found some unique ways to meet the needs of children with learning disabilities. And I appreciate the Department of Education and the New Hampshire Association of Special Ed Administrators and any other vehicle to share those best practices among school districts.
Is it a matter of property tax wealth, Bonnie, that the town that Kimberly moved to just didn't have enough of a property tax base to hire the professionals that it takes to carry out these services in a meaningful way?
That's possible, but cost doesn't drive the decisions. It certainly is a factor, but if there are two different services that will meet a child's needs equally, certainly you can pick the less expensive one. But it may not be that that school district was doing less than they had to do. It may be that Concord has some programs that allow them to do more than they're required to do, or to do it in a more creative way.
All right. Thank you for the call. And I'm glad that things worked out for you, Kimberly. Here's an email from Sean. My wife and I realized that typical school environments weren't going to work for our autistic son in Montessori school. We are fortunate enough to be in a financial position where we can take care of him at home, but hearing about this really frustrates me. There are New Hampshire kids with autism and special needs, regardless of whether New Hampshire is there for us or not. Sean, thank you for that. Can you talk about the rise in children diagnosed with autism, Santina, and how that has affected New Hampshire's school systems?
Right.
So when we every year we have to do data, and I don't want to talk about the numbers per se, but what we have seen was that there were students who did have autism 10 years ago, but their label or their identification for special ed would have been a different identification. So what we're seeing now is that we have this category called autism, and it helps to define things that we might see, behaviors that we might see, a learning style that we might see.
So what would you advise, and anybody can jump in on this, right, someone like Sean, who is educating, they're educating his son at home, would you say, Bonnie, you know, there's enough good stuff going on in some of the public schools in New Hampshire, so give it another try?
I think that parents should explore what's happening in the public school by having their child evaluated, having an IEP team meeting to decide what services that child would need if the child is eligible for special education. Every year, new and different strategies and approaches are developed or spread throughout the state, but that child shouldn't have to be educated at home unless that's the parent's choice. The parents can choose whatever setting they want, but the school district does have an obligation to provide a free, appropriate public education, and so they can consider that, certainly. And there has been a rise in children who have been diagnosed with autism, and we see that really affecting early intervention services as well as school districts in needing to provide some additional services or more intensive ABA services, for example, to that
ABA
small
is what?
Applied behavior analysis,
okay,
to that small group of students who need that.
You know, as we talk about what public schools are supposed to do, what they do or don't do, I did want to ask you, Jane, about public charter schools. Now, New Hampshire doesn't have a ton of these, but they're growing. The number is growing slowly. What are the rules that these public charter schools are under in terms of providing special education services?
Well, charter schools are public schools, and certainly the LEA in which the student is from is responsible for ensuring that student with a disability has a free and appropriate public education. So if they have an IEP, the school district is responsible for providing those services to that child that's in the charter school. So depending upon what their IEP calls for, if it calls for speech-language therapy or psychological services or some specialized reading, the school district is responsible for providing those services. They're also responsible if a student is referred to special education for making sure that someone gets out there and conducts the evaluation and conducts the IEP team, make the determination on eligibility or not. And with the growing number of kids in charter schools, this is an additional expense to our school districts. We try very hard to estimate how many kids we're going to see in our charter schools and how many are currently enrolled. But we're hearing from our special ed administrators that that's a growing number. And with the current shortages of staff, it's oftentimes difficult to get those services out to our charter schools.
So some charters in the past, Jane, in the past, have been criticized for discouraging special education students to apply or to enroll, either subtly or overtly. What's your perception of how this plays out today?
We haven't heard that. I mean, charter schools have to have a lottery and accept all kids. Whether or not that's happening, I can't really speak to that. That's not something that I've heard.
Bonnie?
I shared that with somebody who was involved in the leadership of the charter school movement in New Hampshire, that that's something that Santino and I were at a conference in another state, and that was openly discussed. How can you skim those kids out? And the person in New Hampshire was horrified because that's something that they said, we would never even consider doing that. So we really don't hear of that happening very much. Sometimes it's just not a good match for a child, depending on their learning style, whether the child has a disability or not. But there is not the level of blatant discrimination that you may see in other areas of the country.
Go ahead, Santina.
And there is a high level of coordination among our districts. So if two students were going to charter school A and they both needed reading instruction, you would see our school district starting to coordinate again, not only for resources, but the effectiveness of, rather than two districts sending two staff out.
All right, well, let's take another call. And this is Ashley in Brookline. Hi, Ashley. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my comment is regarding every year we have to pass a budget in our town. And we're in Brookline, I would say we're arguably one of the best school districts in the state. So that means that we have high taxes. But unfortunately, we have a lot of people that don't have children still in the system, and they come to the meetings. And I understand their frustration. I kind of feel like they think it's a gentrification of some sort. But they're always opposing, you know, the budget and especially the special ed. For example, this deliberative session, we had a proposal that we raised an appropriate amount of sum of money, but that would go into a trust fund if it wasn't spent, and they were saying that it was unnecessary. And that's my comment.
So feeling some pushback at town meeting, Ashley, for spending money on education in general or special education specifically?
Both, but this past year was specifically about special education because they thought that if we weren't sure what the spending was, why are we raising this money? And it's considered, they thought it was more like fat in the budget. But we can't really, you know, you can't always say what you're going to need for special education because a child can move into the district at any time and we have to provide those services.
Okay, Ashley, thank you for calling. Bonnie, can see you and jump in.
I know the guesstimation that's required by school districts is challenging. And we sometimes do hear about people who don't have children in the school system, you know, elderly people and so on, who don't want to have to pay for special education costs, or people who don't have kids with disabilities wonder how that money's being spent. And I think it's important for people to know that special education or disability is the only minority you can join. And so, for example, the day before our son was born, I really didn't even think about special education. The next day, it was just about the only thing I could think about. And that can happen to anybody's grandchild, neighbor, friend. And so it is something that impacts everyone. The benefit to society will make a difference to each and every one of us.
Well, and we heard from a listener earlier whose daughter had a stroke at 4 and a half. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things happen that are unexpected. Thank you so much for the call, Ashley. Ed writes us from Manchester. He says, because those funds were not put to use, that's the federal funding that we talked mm-hmm. about earlier, won't that impact funding for the next cycle? Ed says, is the impact of fewer students offset by the increase in the number of students with Asperger's and autism? So two good questions, Ed. Thank you very much. And to you first, I think, Santina, because those federal funds weren't put to use, does that impact funding for the next cycle?
It will not impact funding for the next cycle. We were very transparent with the federal government about this money, and we're working collaboratively with them in order to get the okay to redistribute it. The other question was,
is the impact of fewer students, because in many communities the right. population of school-age kids is just going down overall, so he says, is the impact of fewer students being offset by the increase in the number of students with Asperger's and autism?
The way that the state funding for special education is calculated going to the districts, it's based on a per student. So if the student number goes down, the cost would go down. But the federal funds can always be used for students with autism.
Okay. And I wanted to let listeners too know that we had hoped to have Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue on with us to talk about this issue. We've tried multiple times to get the commissioner on the show. We've been unsuccessful so far. We'll continue to try. We consider these shows a great opportunity for listeners to address leaders of important state agencies. So we'll keep you up to date on that. Ed, thank you very much for the email. You know, as we close out, I did want to ask you all about the legislature. We heard earlier from the governor about increasing special education funding, and Jane, you touched on that a little bit. Are there bills in the legislature that you are watching with the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators that have to do with, you know, your purview and the parents and families that you're trying to help?
One of the bills that we were watching fairly carefully was House Bill 677, which was related to the suspension and expulsion of students and ensuring that school districts had multi-tiered systems of support, that students who are being considered for suspension and expulsion be given functional behavioral assessment plans. It had a variety of different aspects to it. And while we fully supported the concept, for us, there were just too many questions unanswered before we could really fully support that bill moving forward. So I think that's being put into study for the current time, and hopefully we can come back to the table and reconsider some of that language.
What sorts of questions?
One was around the funding. If students who were being considered for suspension were going to have a functional behavioral assessment, who would do that? Where would the monies come from? The same with behavioral intervention plans. Who would be responsible for writing them? Would there be any parameters around that? They weren't really defined. Who would be responsible for implementation and monitoring? All of these are great things, but we weren't quite sure how that was all going to play out.
Yeah, so not enough for the legislature to say, you shall. You guys came back and said, how shall we?
Right.
So what about town meeting, Bonnie? That's also upon us. What role do parents play in these town meetings, especially as our caller Ashley said, you know, the subject of school funding and special education funding comes
right.
up?
I think it's important for parents to, just like any good citizen, to go to town meetings and to advocate for the things that they believe are important, to help explain why these things are important. But it can be challenging sometimes, especially if everyone is looking at you and saying, you're the reason our taxes are so high. I hope that special ed directors and others also continue to share that message. To voting is essentially very, very important, and not just at the school district level, but also in the legislature, where there are always bills having to do with special education that people can advocate for or against.
All right. All of you, we have run out of time. Hard to believe. I really want to thank everybody for coming in, and I'm sure we'll cover this again because there's a lot of bills and, as you said, town meeting, and then there's the governor's budget, so lots to follow up on in the future. Jane, it was good to see you. Thank you for being on.
Thank you for having us.
That's Jane Bergeron Beaulieu. She's executive director of the New Hampshire Association of Special Education Administrators. Bonnie, good to see you. Thank you. That's Bonnie Dunham. She's law and policy specialist at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education. And Santina, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's Santina Thibodeau, State Director of Special Education at the New Hampshire Department of Education. And again, check out our website. We always have links and more information there. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. And we're also on Instagram at nhprexchange. So check it out for some behind-the-scenes photos and background information. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.